Welcome once again to Dual World in episode 86, 7, I should say. Wow, I should learn how to count, especially when I'm looking at the number in front of me. This week, we're going to switch off the show format just a bit, being that it is our big Halloween spectacular episode. And we're going to focus on that segment first, and then we're going to go into news. And if we have time, what we've been saying. Joining me this week, our Jack O'Lantern experts, we have Daniel.
Hello.
And we have Martin.
Hi.
So, yes, let's get this underway. Halloween, horror, suspense has been a very big part of gaming, but it really kind of took off in the mid-90s with the release of Resident Evil. And since then, horror has kind of always found its way into video games in some fashion, even if it's not necessary in the Resident Evil franchise anymore. So, you know, we kind of reached out to other people as well and we'll include their answers as we go along. But, I mean, let's get this started. And this is actually something that we discussed when we were coming up with this idea. It's like, what do you consider horror or Halloween aspects of a video game?
Well, there's several ways you can go about it, isn't there? Like, I mean, obviously, the most obvious way of doing it is to make a game that is scary as shit. And, you know, that can be one. Double Fine have done, like, Double Fine's costume quest, you know, that's a kind of sort of nice, sort of more whimsical take on the whole Halloween thing, like, because obviously it's from a kid's perspective, and it's like a fairly basic turn-based RPG, and it's all about the costumes that the kids are wearing and stuff. I think that's pretty cool. We need to see more of the thematic Halloween stuff instead of just, oh, this game's really scary.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, that brings up a good point, because I think Costume Quest is actually one of the few that is actually a Halloween-themed game.
And yeah, instead of it being scary, like, which is sort of what Halloween's about, it's actually a Halloween game.
Yeah, you even go around collecting candy and stuff like that. And so, you know, it works the theme into the core gameplay idea, and there aren't many games that actually do that. What we traditionally think of is games like Resident Evil and Silent Hill, which are kind of, you know, the traditional ghosts and goblins.
Yeah, and there's more movies that do the sort of thematic Halloween thing, and especially like Tim Burton. So, you know, it'd be nice to see more games do that, because the art style of Costume Quest is actually really, it's one of the more attractive things about the game.
Yes, if it was a good game, it would have been so much better for me. but yeah, I mean, part of the reason we brought this up is actually, I think we were discussing Left 4 Dead, because it's not a traditional, it's not a scary game exactly, it's not really based on horror. You are usually well equipped to handle any situation that you come across, and there's four people in a party, which always, horror and co-op has always been kind of anti, you know, like, inversely related to a lot of games, because you saw the big stink that happened when EA announced Dead Space 3 would have co-op gameplay. The same thing happened with Resident Evil 5, because to a lot of people, once you add another party to that game, it's no longer about being isolated and frightened. It's, you know, it takes away that suspense, but do you think that's necessarily true?
Which I think is on some level true, but at least these games are still filled with usually nasty monsters, which, if you go by, like, film theory, use primal fears of human beings. Like, if you look at, let's say, Left 4 Dead, you have co-op multiplayer, sure, but you're still confronted with lots of splattering and zombies, which are basically a primal fear of us, with the dead coming back to life. So there's still a horror theme there, and I think it's still to be considered horror. Just not, maybe not the same kind as Silent Hill or whatever have you.
I think horror games, if you were to make a co-op horror game, it would make it so much better if you were to say, this game is local co-op only, by design. Because, you know, one of the funniest things that me and my roommates have done is take the one that's scared of games the most and make him play Amnesia. and we just sit behind and, you know, because it's funny. And also we get scared as well, because obviously, like, because we see exactly what he sees, but we can mock him at the same time. So I reckon if more games...
Such fantastic friends.
I think, if you were to have a more couch cop, because couch cop experience, it would, the scares would be a lot easier, because you can guarantee that they're going to see the same thing at the same time. Whereas, you just don't get that kind of same feeling if you're playing with somebody online. Because you can easily set up, the atmosphere. If you're in a couch co-op environment, you can turn the lights off, you can shut the curtains, you know. Whereas you can't guarantee that the other person on the other side of the internet is going to do that.
Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily change the experience for you.
And I don't think, and the thing with online is, it's obviously, because, you could be doing one thing, and your friend could be doing something that's completely opposite in a different place, and so that kind of limits the sort of, because a lot of scares in games are very scripted, so you can't really, I don't know, if somebody else is doing something else or concentrating on something else, you're not gonna you're not gonna really sort of get the full impact of the scripted sequences that are supposed to be scary. So I don't think that would work very well. I don't think if you put online co-op in it, you're basically killing the horror off completely.
I can see that point, but at the same time, I think it depends on how you design the game. I'm a huge fan of Left 4 Dead, and the reason Left 4 Dead works for me as a horror game isn't necessarily because it does jump scares, because it usually telegraphs whenever an enemy or, a super infected, I forget what they're called exactly, a special, is in the area. But what it does and what it does well is that once they attack you, you're vulnerable. You can't defend
yourself.
Yeah,
well, the thing with Left 4 Dead is more about being action heavy environment where you don't necessarily know everything that's going on at one time, instead of it being scary. It's more about how the hell do I deal with this situation? Oh no, it's going wrong over there. Oh no, it's going wrong on the other side of the map. What one do I do? You know, it's more scary. The feelings that you get while playing Left 4 Dead are more of a byproduct of the way the game is designed, instead of we're intentionally going for that.
But that's what I mean, though. It's if Left 4 Dead is designed around the co-op experience, it's designed. I assume if it was a single-player game, there'd be a way for you to fight off the tank on your own. There'd be a way for you to knock the hunter off 50 pounds. But it's not. It's designed around the fact that you have to depend on other people, which sometimes is a lot more frightening than anything else you can count on.
Oh, yeah.
Because you can't always depend on people. I mean, I'm sure you've played this game at random. I mean, you have people who are either goofing off and down their own teammates, or you have people who just kind of book it for the end. And I'm sure you've had experiences. I've had this as well. I've done this from times where you're kind of near a safe house and you make a judgment call. Do you go back and save your partner, or do you rush for the safe house door and knock yourself in? And it's those type of things where it's not necessarily the traditional jump out and scare you horror, but it's more like, you know what, I have to depend on three people. I have to make sure they're safe by the end of this, but I also have to protect myself. But I can't do it on my own without them, because if I get attacked ahead of them and they can't come to me in time, I'm screwed.
Yeah.
Yeah, but what basically the game is doing is to make it simpler, it's actually taking control away from you. You're not entirely in control of your, let's call it destiny in this game. Unlike other games where everything just depends on you, and taking that away can be a very scary thing.
Yeah, and I mean, it's why it works. Contrast that to something like Resident Evil 5, where honestly you don't need a co-op partner, because you can kind of run through that game solo. I can't think of any instance other than when the game forces you, you both have to be at the door to open it. I can't think of any instances where it's like, crap, I'm not well equipped, I can't knock off this enemy by myself, because you're never in that position. It's always kind of like, oh yeah, I got this rocket launcher, I'll handle this, and you just hang back and you're pretty or whatever.
Yeah, pretty much.
So yeah, I think that's a big part of, you know, again, it's a, and this goes for any game, not just horror game. It depends on how you design the game to, you know, to play to its strength. And Left 4 Dead was designed on co-op, so they made it so that you have to depend on other people. Or Resident Evil, and I assume Dead Space 3 is probably going to fall in the same camp. It's kind of designed around being a experience where you can kind of John Rambo it. So,
probably.
Are there any games that you usually see people associate with Halloween that you don't count or consider?
I don't know, actually. I haven't really thought about that.
Neither have I. Just ask the question. Well, no, because you always see, like, you know, like, you. I mean, for the most part, you kind of get the same type of examples with games. You get Resident Evil, you get Silent Hill, you get Amnesia, you get Fear, you get Condemned, you get Dead Space.
I wouldn't say Fear. I don't know. I just feel like Fear is too heavy on shooting. Like in not. I mean, I know Left 4 Dead is nothing but shooting for the most part, but it's like Fear. It just seems like I don't know. It just seems like it's a first-person shooter with a few creepy shit in, and it's not like I don't know. It just doesn't feel intentionally like they're trying to make a scary game. Like from the outset, like Condemned, you can tell because obviously it's very focused on melee and the atmosphere is, you know, this. I mean, I know, and Fear doesn't really have the same atmosphere. I don't know. I just don't really count Fear, especially now that Fear 3 is just a straight up action game.
Well, I mean, I was gonna say the same. You can kind of. I read at Resident Evil because I assume most people don't count Resident Evil 5 or 6 as horror games at this point.
And I wouldn't say 4 either. I would say 1, 2, and 3.
I think 4 kind of works in that, not in the, oh my gosh, everything's jumping out to scare me, but it kind of works in that isolated, alone in this giant, infested town. And it still kind of limits the things you can and can't do at once. And I think, you know, I think that's where gaming works best. I mean, as far as horror goes, is limiting what the fae can do, especially in a genre that you're just kind of used to being a superhero in almost every other video game. You have like 15 guns that holds 100,000 ammo. You're never short on hitting grenades, and you can beat people down with your fists of fury, even when there's like 10 people shooting at you. So yeah, there's that. We also sent out, and I'll ask you folks this first before I get to some of the answers we got, is like, what is the scariest enemy you've encountered in a video game?
Probably the goddamn water thing in Amnesia. Jesus Christ. Because it's the best decision they made with that is the fact that you can't see it. You can only see where it goes.
Yeah.
So the idea is there's a
water
like a corridor.
Thing is...
Yeah, there's like a corridor, and there's boxes, and this is going. I'll speak. So you've got a corridor, and it's full of water. Well, not full of water, but the ground is got. There's got water in it, on it, and there's boxes, and you have to jump between the boxes. But the thing that's chasing you and the thing that can kill you, you can't actually see. You can see its footsteps, and that is it. And it makes you, you have to put a valve in a socket, and you have to turn the valve, and then you have to get from one end of the corridor to the other before the door shuts. And that is so tense, and it's so...
What about you, Martin?
I don't know, the water thing in Amnesia was pretty bad for me. I guess almost anything in Silent Hill 2. these faceless things that you can't really quite make out what they are, or quite what they do, combined with the weird animations, just really work for me. Yeah, I guess those.
Okay, and mine's is kind of a stone answer. I mean, if somebody replied to us, and I thought it was a great answer, and I actually would agree, is The Witch from Left 4 Dead. Nothing shuts down your game faster than hearing her cry.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah. And then you think, oh, crap, now we've got to find her. Not only do you have to find her, but you have to stay away from her at the same time, and it's so easy to sort of accidentally bump into her or shoot her by accident, and that's it, your game's just gone to crap, especially if you're on the higher difficulties.
Yeah, and because it's it's randomly generated, so there's you never know where she is. Like sometimes she can be hiding in a corner that you have to pass by, or she's right by a door, and you're you shut down everything, you turn off the flashlight, you go melee only, everybody's tiptoeing past her, and you know that there's gonna be one person who sets her off, and then that screech, and then she chases after people.
Yeah,
and it's really not much you can do once she's set on you, or if your teammates are really fast.
Yeah.
So she's not you don't encounter her that often, and you actually can't avoid her for the most part. But
especially when you're playing like the daytime levels in Left 4 Dead 2, and she just walks into a sort of narrow corridor that you have to go through, and it's like, great, thanks.
Or when, and this is what some people do when they do versus, is like if you're a certain type of infected, you hang out by her because people have to shoot over her over you. And that usually triggers her anyhow.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she works on so many levels. But, again, she's not, you can deal with her. You can shotgun her. There's an achievement for shotgunning her once and stuff like that. But it's a very intimidating cry no matter how many times you've played that game.
I have a bonus question for you guys. What was the scariest monster for you when you were little? Because I distinctly remember me playing, when I was very young, Maniac Mansion, which is inherently a very funny game, but for some reason, after playing it then at night, I was definitely afraid of being turned into one of those blue things that you encountered in that game.
So you won't know what you're talking about unless you've actually played this game. It's not a game, really, but the Game Boy camera, right? I had a Game Boy camera, and I loved my Game Boy camera. And then one day, I found this goddamn screen, and it says, "Who are you running from?" And the music goes, "Brrr," and it has this god-awful picture of some woman with some weird, like, crap drawn on her face. And that scared the crap out of me.
And mine isn't, again, it's not a traditional scary. I'm sure a lot of people who played this game had the similar experience. But Fanto from Super Mario Bros. 2, you never held the key for that long. You always just kind of tossed it along your path until you got out of there. Because he's like a slasher villain.
Yeah.
He haunts you down and you can't really kill him.
True.
He's just chasing you and waiting for you to screw up. And there's nothing you can do. It's and that face is just, it's not evil. It's just like he's like smirking at you, like he knows he has you in his grasp. But yeah, I'm going with Fanto. Just to rattle off some of the picks we got, we asked this, and I think favorite horror game franchise for people, and we got from Nick DeYoung, Pyramid Head from Silent Hill 2, from Paper Cam, Iron Maiden and Resident Evil 4. From Nemowill, we got Nemesis from Resident Evil 3. This is one that I thought was kind of interesting. A Vicious Kawaii said Goro from Mortal Kombat.
I like that one. Yeah.
I think Goro is not, I don't think he was scary. It's just I hated fighting him because he's so difficult to actually fight, since you can't do most of your traditional moves against him, other than freezing him and uppercutting him, which is how the only way I beat the original Mortal Kombat when I was younger.
Also depends on how young you was when you played it. Maybe that's the reason.
Yeah. Little Big Trouble said Scissor Man in Clock Tower.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah. Depending on which Clock Tower.
they didn't specify. So
just assume the original was the best one.
Yeah.
The SNES one?
It was on the PS1 as well.
Yeah, but the Super Nintendo one was not incredibly scary. At least, I think.
This is an interesting one, even though I'd go with the other. Did you Excentra said the third from Halo? I've always thought the third reminded me of Metroid, and Metroid freaked me out a lot more than they do. Because Metroids are, again, the type of enemies that you can beat in certain ways. Fabian said the Haunt and Thief, or Crimson Heads and Resident Evil Remake.
Mm.
The person I stole my answer from, Jason Brown, said The Witch from Left 4 Dead Games.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody said, I don't know if this is a joke or not, The Water in Fallout New Vegas.
The what?
The water.
What?
I don't know. Could you drown?
I don't know. No, I think what he's talking about is if you put hardcore mode on, you actually have to drink. Otherwise, you die.
Oh, right. And you get the H.
So, obviously, he's probably referring to the lack of water that a lot of the time.
Okay. Dan Jones.
Okay.
Dan Jones said the hybrids from System Shock 2.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
Roy and Max said Space Pirates from the Metroid franchise. Somebody said Nemesis, Pyramid Head, and Sephiroth. Hector the Virus said the Regenerators from Resident Evil 4.
Yeah, for some reason, I understand those choices. For me, for most part, monsters that I can't quite figure out what they are, I think. Like Regenerators, the things from Silent Hill 2. Maybe that's also the reason why I enjoy Carpenter's The Thing so much.
I think that plays a great part in it, and this is, we had a monster movie podcast with Nerds on the Rocks this week, and one of the things I came to the conclusion is that sometimes what you can't figure out, what you can't see, is a lot scarier to you because you fill in the blanks in your head a lot of the times.
Yeah, okay.
So especially if it's an enemy, like especially with Resident Evil 8 games, where a lot of these enemies were humans that kind of had stuff pop out of them, you didn't know if you were going to kill somebody or if you were just going to make them worse.
Yeah.
So it was always that element of, like, should I kill this person, or if I stomp their head out, is that giant bug, the parasite, it kind of pop out.
Mm. On the other hand, for me, it's still, zombies are a big thing for me. I still enjoy zombies and monsters. For me, zombies are the other most effective horror monster, I think. For some reason, they just speak to my primal fears.
Fair enough. This is one that speaks to my primal fears. Mandu Creed said the Chozo Ghost from the Metroid Prime franchise. I'm not a huge fan of anything I can't see.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of those things, and especially in the Metroid Prime games, the only way you can combat them was that you needed a special visor, otherwise they're invisible to you, like 75% of the time. So, especially if you're in a crowded situation where you're flipping through it, it's just really, ugh. I don't know this one, they answered me too, and I don't remember what it was. It's this really cute pink bunny from a game that ends up killing you, apparently. I forget the name. Again, more pyramid heads. Somebody said the Goomba.
Say what?
Goombas.
Someone was really shit at Super Mario.
Either that, they were just sticking with me. But
I mean, if you think about it, as if you try to figure out the Mario when you were really young, I don't know. Seems like a scary place.
I don't think it's scary. I think it's just, it's one of the Goombas are so harmless. They walk in one direction. You don't even have to kill them to avoid them.
But they are weird mushroom monsters, and when you're young, you hate mushrooms.
Fair enough. Well, and somebody said the ing from Metroid Prime 2, which is okay. They're more, I was more afraid of the environment than most of the enemies in Metroid Prime 2. So.
Mm.
So yeah, I think, you know, some solid choices, a variety of games. Not all of them are actually from horror games. We got, you know, Final Fantasy, we got Metroid, we got Mario, we got Fallout. So yeah, it's nice to see. There were some that I was surprised were missed. I thought Red Deads would be is that what they're called? Redeads?
What?
From the Ocarina of Time.
I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember either. But yeah, I expected some other ones to be up there, but they weren't, so what can you do?
Yeah, I think a problem with a lot of horror games is we don't have a lot of monster variety. I'm not blaming zombies. I think, in general, if I remember playing Nocturne, I don't know if anyone knows the game, and what I like about that game, they had like the premise of being like this secret organization which hunts down different beings, and then you encounter a lot of different stuff. I mean, how many games can you think of where werewolves make an appearance? I mean, besides Castlevania, maybe.
I was talking about that as well. It's like there are a lot of enemies that you don't often see mummies either.
Yeah, mummies. Yeah, true.
And even vampires, you kind of get Dracula and you get the Blood Rain series, and that's about it. You get zombies everywhere, I think, just because they're easy targets and they're easy to kill. Where like, with werewolves and vampires and stuff like that, you know, there are always that you have to kill them in such a specific way that people probably just avoid it.
Yeah, it's probably also harder to think about game mechanics, which make those monsters fun.
Yeah. And that could be true. I mean, especially, you know, a werewolf moves fast, they bite, you know, they bite hard. And technically speaking, if they bite you, it's supposed to transform. Which is, again, not something many games do. Like, zombies scratch and bite you all the time, you don't actually turn into one.
If someone actually would do that. I mean, they kind of did with the Resident Evil Outbreak file games. You could get infected and then turn to a zombie, but that game was crap in general, so I didn't care for it. So having this mechanic in a fun game would be great.
Yeah, I was gonna say that. Honestly, that's exactly what Left 4 Dead Zombie U does. And that
but not in control of the zombie though.
No, but I mean, it does have that, like, if you get bit and if you get scratched, you do transform into a zombie. And if you go back, you actually have to kill your former self or a variation of the player's character. I mentioned this when I had my impressions. It's kind of fun to beat up other people's characters.
Yeah.
Because you also get to do this online if, like, one of your friends die and you encounter them before they get back to their former selves.
Hmm. Yeah, but I would enjoy the mechanic of actually then being in control of the zombie.
Yeah, it's kind of weird too. I mean, even in Left 4 Dead, when you get controlled, especially, you don't get direct control of zombies.
Yeah.
In Zombie U, you kind of play a zombie game, like a defense tower game. You get to put them out there, but you don't actually get to control the zombie itself.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting.
But again, I probably would be pretty cool in a game like DayZ, I think, when you could actually, if you died by a zombie infection, if then you were in control of the zombies, because in DayZ, as far as I understand, people are relatively safe in the woods and stuff, and not in the cities, but if there were at least some player-controlled zombies, other players could not feel as safe, I think that would be interesting.
Yeah,
and would add even more to the survival aspect.
I think the problem with that, though, and you often see this, is that humans are always better equipped in these games to survive. So you'd probably end up with a lot of people who just kind of either start anew or rage quit. Because, I mean, Halo does this with infection.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, the infected don't get a fair shake just because they're not as well equipped. You basically have to wait. You either have to attack in groups, which makes sense, or you have to wait until people start running out of bullets. Because, you know, like, they have long-range weapons, and you have to be, you actually have to make physical contact with them.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, didn't Aliens vs. Predator 2 have a game mode where you played as the aliens vs. the marines, and
yes.
Then you turned?
That was fucking cool.
Yeah.
That was awesome. Turning the marines into aliens, and then having tried to survive. That was fun.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of ground for it. It's just going to, you know, we have to retrain players to accept that they won't always be like a Superman in games, like I said.
Yeah.
But here we go. And finally, I guess we can talk about favorite horror games or franchises or series and all that fun jazz. Anybody has a favorite?
I would just have to pick Amnesia, and I can't wait for Machine for Pig so I can put my friend through that.
You are a cruel human being.
What can I say?
You can say sorry to your poor friend.
Nah.
I have to say, until recently, it probably would have been Silent Hill 2, and specifically Silent Hill 2. I think that game just works on basically every level. But Amnesia really, really got to me, I have to say. So for me, it's also Amnesia. I think the game is incredibly well thought out when it comes to how the mechanics worked with the actual horror elements. Like, you can't actually look at your enemies and just... basically creates opportunities for you to get scared again, even though you might think you're safe, but you have to look away so not quite sure, and stuff like that, and being basically saved by the dark, but also afraid of the dark, because your character might get insane. It all just works so well together, and so well thought out, with I think a pretty interesting narrative as well. That game is just incredible, and like Daniel said, a Machine for Pigs, I have very, very high hopes for it. I mean, it's not by the same team, but by the guys who made Dear Esther, I think, if I remember correctly.
And if nothing else, they know about Atmosphere.
Yeah, they know about Atmosphere. And I'm sure Frictional Games will probably kind of look over it and make sure that it's still on the same quality level. I'm sure of it. And whatever Frictional Games makes next, apparently some kind of sci-fi horror game, I will be there.
Yeah, I will eat that stuff up.
And for me, especially in the light of this week's news story, my favorite was Eternal Darkness. And it's not too much of a horror game. I just like it for the fact that it does mess with the player a lot more outside of the game, or I guess meta messing with the player. And like, a lot of the stuff that happens to you isn't like a big jump, a big scare. It's just subtle things that you don't notice. Your save data being corrupted, you know, phones ringing and you not being able to answer, blood on the walls. And it's like stuff that kind of seeps into the game without you actually noticing it. But it does it, and it kind of freaks you out, but it doesn't scare you. And again, I don't necessarily think you need to be scared or frightened to enjoy something or make it horror. But I think that Eternal Darkness did a great job of just trying to mess with the player as much as possible. I mean, it was so bad, I remember owning it to a friend in high school. It's like 2 days later, he gave it back to me. He's like, I'm never playing this game again. I don't know what type of devil ship you're into.
That's brilliant.
Daniel, I didn't give it to him to frighten him, or he wanted to play because he heard good things about it. He came back to me and he was just so freaked out by the game. And again, it's not because it does anything really, you know, groundbreaking as far as like big scares and jumps, but it does really, really mess the play on a psychological level.
Yeah, but my favorite part of that is when you basically lose control of yourself. Like literally you can't control yourself anymore. Or when you try to reload and shoot yourself or something like that. That's just cool.
Yeah. So that's our favorite. Once again, we'll open up the floor real quick to other people who gave any suggestions. Paper Cam said Dead Space. Max on Movie said Silent Hill, which is sad because if he's a movie fan, that probably means he saw the Silent Hill film.
It's scary, but for a completely different reason.
Don't watch the Silent Hill film.
I enjoy it, but part of the reason I think I enjoyed it is because I've never actually played the games. So,
yeah, well,
I know of plenty of people that hated them, even without playing the games. So,
well, you have to also realize that the threshold for video game movies is really, 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 really low. So, I mean, up until Wreck-It Ralph, which comes out this week, and I recommend everybody sees it, I don't think we really had a truly great video game movie. And it's always been like, oh, this is good, this is decent, I enjoy it, so it's kind of always been propped up. Because I enjoyed Mortal Kombat, I enjoyed Street Fighter, I enjoyed Doom. But I wouldn't consider them great movies by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, you enjoy something like Mortal Kombat for entirely different reasons.
Yeah. So, apparently this is a real game, and I'm sure I'm going to butcher the pronunciation. I don't know. Phantasm Margarita. I don't know. It's Phantasm
Phantasmagoria.
There we go.
Phantasmagoria.
There we go. You two got it. I thought somebody was making up a word, but apparently it's an actual game.
Yeah, it is. It's an old PC adventure game with lots of FMV.
Like the good old days.
Yeah.
Well, I can't really complain because we, instead of FMVs now, we just get CGI. Video games.
It's also kind of trashy. I can already, at the same time, awesome.
Again, you can enjoy bad stuff.
Did anyone mention Seventh Guest? That's also a good one, I guess.
No. Craig Holmes mentioned Left 4 Dead. Somebody mentioned Eternal Darkness. What else did we get? We got Resident Evil. We got two for Luigi's Mansion, which I thought were really interesting picks. I mean, they technically are a horror game.
Yeah.
They're in a haunted mansion. They deal with ghosts.
They are.
They just aren't really scary, per se. But they're a horror
I
game.
I mean, you wouldn't say Zombieland is really scary or... Evil Dead 3 is scary. I mean, Army of Darkness. Sorry. But it's still technically horror. I mean, horror comedy is a thing.
Yeah, that's true. I was going to say, and this isn't a horror comedy, but it falls in line. I just watched 28 Days Later last night for the first time in a long time, and that's not really... I mean, it's a horror movie, but like, it's not really about the zombies or the infected, because they don't really show up that much during the movie.
The best zombie movies are not about zombies.
Yeah, it's about the... Yeah, I think sometimes people forget that. But
In Dawn of the Dead, I mean, there are a couple of action sequences, but most of it is about the interaction between the people and how they live in this...
Well,
in the shopping mall.
Yeah, Walking Dead works on that principle.
Yeah.
I think sometimes the TV show has to ignore it because people want action in their shows, and a lot of times the characters are really stupid. But yeah, I think
the Walking Dead TV show is kind of a different thing because you have to remember comic pacing and TV pacing is a very different thing.
I know, but I'm just saying a lot of the times what happens with the show. At least from what I pick up is that you have to have like design, like, especially this season, like the first two episodes that started off with them killing zombies, and not in small numbers either. Where,
yeah,
like,
I was surprised to see that much action.
Yeah, you can kind of, and I think part of it was because a lot of people complained about the first half of season two being really deliberately paced, where it's like the hunt for the girl, and the problem with that is like people don't want. So drama, they kind of want action in every episode. They want the plot to move forward. And the comic book can kind of get away with just moving it inch by inch because you know they're playing a long game.
Yeah.
And that's the nature of the beast, where TV is a week-to-week thing, and you kind of want something to happen every week for you to turn it next week.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even I... I am reading The Walking Dead, and even I was disappointed with season two, because, like I said, pacing for TV and the comic are just two very different things. And having a show just about talking doesn't work. TV is as much, or film is as much about talking as about showing. And that's, I think, kind of different in comics. It works a bit better to have more, it can work to have more dialogue.
Yeah, I think the other problem is, and this can go either way, and we'll kind of get off of this because The Walking Dead isn't the... I mean, there's a great game, but I haven't actually played it yet. The other thing is just that the dialogue hasn't always been The Walking Dead's strongest suit, and having an hour of that really kind of highlights that it's not something you want to hear every week. Mm. I mean, a lot of the characters are... They have kind of evolved, but for a while they were kind of bigots and racist and stuff like that. But yeah, I think that's it for our horror games Halloween themed segment. Does you gentlemen have anything to add before we wrap this segment up?
Nope.
Okay. Then we're moving over to news. And there wasn't a lot of news to talk about, but there was one story that has
what
pretty much...
What we got was really big.
Yeah, there has been one story that has dominated the airwaves since, like, Tuesday of this week. And that is the case with... Well, it started with a picture. A picture of Jeff Keighley from GameTrailers.com sitting on a chair next to a Halo 4 poster sponsored by Mountain Dew and Doritos, and having Mountain Dew and Doritos next to him as he shows a product for them. And it started this entire discussion about the role of journalism in video games and the symbiotic relationship between PR and the media. This culminated in an article written by Rob Florent for Eurogamer, in which he called out certain members of the press and certain behaviors that he has seen. One of the
he didn't call anyone being corrupt. He just mentioned people who engaged in behavior which might be questionable.
And just for the record, I think this is a huge part of it, is he didn't do anything that wasn't out of their mouth. He actually took quotes from somebody's tweets, Bjorn Wainwright, who works at MCV, and he put that in his article, and she got upset with it, and her company, MCV, I don't really know what that stands for, this is where it kind of gets murky. Some are saying there was a lawsuit involved, some are saying there wasn't. There was threat of libel or slander, which I hear in Europe is a really big thing.
Well, in the UK, it's after the Leveson inquiry and the state of the media and the phone hacking scandal. It's a really big thing, and it's a big problem. So, yeah, it's... I just love that, like, after MCV took issue with what was posted in the article, which was just a direct quote, the Streisand effect kicked in.
Yes, which is a term I just learned this week, but I've seen it
really?
In action. I've never heard somebody describe it as that, but I've seen it in action several times before, and it's true. The more you try to hide something, the worse it becomes for you in this game.
And it did get worse. It did get worse for Miss Wainwright. She said several times, well, she said that she never reviewed anything by Square Enix because she worked as a consultant for them at some point. And then it turned out that she did review things from Square Enix several times, in fact, including Deus Ex, Sleeping Dogs, and there was some other game. And, you know, and The thing is like the article in question that was posted to Eurogamer was basically just saying, you know, you need to be wary of this kind of thing because it does it can happen, and you know, and he looked at her tweets and you know she tweeted in promotion of some game that she hadn't played before in order to win a PS3, and then if you look back, she has tweets about her getting memorabilia from Square Enix for regarding to Lara Croft. The header image on her Twitter page is one of Lara Croft. So it could quite easily be, you know, you could quite easily say, oh, this woman's in the pocket of Square Enix, you know? And then she decided that, oh, people have realised that I've started reviewing stuff for Square Enix, so she started removing any mention of Square Enix from previous employers on her various profiles on various pages. And I just can't believe, like, how big this got. And especially after the image, you know, the image that was circling the internet, especially on NeoGAF, of Jeff Keighley sitting in front of sitting right next to a Doritos setup and in front of a Halo 4 sort of promo thing that had Mountain Dew slapped all over it.
Yeah, and it shows a lot of problems, and there are stuff that, you know, it's a very murky line. I don't, like, you know, you mentioned the Square Enix stuff. Like, there's no problem with her having Lara Croft as her background, having Lara Croft as her head, or being excited for the next Tomb Raider game. I mean, I can't really speak. I have Mario as my icon, and my background is from DC Comics. The problem is that you want to avoid situations where it can look like you're being impartial to a product. Being a consultant with Square Enix and not telling that to your audience is a big no-no. For example, I don't know if you're... whenever Game Trailers used to review the Rock Band games, they would always tell you that Viacom owned Game Trailers and they owned Harmonix, who made the Rock Band games. And, you know, that was clear that there's a... I mean, granted, you don't trust the reviews in that in general, but it made it clear that this is...
At least they're being honest about it.
Yeah, they're being upfront about it.
You need... If something like this occurs, basically, you need to be transparent about it, or... Even as for journalists who gets paid to do reviews, you need to take the ethical stand and say, no, I'm not going to review a Square Enix product.
Yeah, I mean, that's
clearly the thing that a real journalist, I'm sorry, I'm going to use this term, should be doing.
Yeah, and that's where it should have started.
My university, just to say it that way. I took a journalistic ethics thing and stuff like that. And one of the things you talk about there is if you go, for example, let's say movie companies sometimes invite journalists to the movie set to see stuff and basically they want you to maybe even generate some excitement about the movie from what you saw there. But if you are the guy who went to such an event, you should not be the guy who actually later reviews this movie.
Yeah,
there's a clear distinction that needs to be made there.
I think Giant Bomb was like that, and I think GameStop was like that as well. But it had a policy that if you went to a preview event, you did not review the title as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And that makes sense. I mean, granted, the ideal thing is to try to avoid these situations as much as possible. But the problem is, and, you know, this is kind of the inbuilt problem with the gaming industry, is that it's a very closed-off industry. So if you don't play ball with them, you're not going to get those exclusive previews and the trailers and stuff until after it hits the web.
Yeah.
That's
exactly the problem. There are some preview events that journalists can't avoid because otherwise you will not get the information.
Well, there are some events you have to go to review the game in the first place.
Well, to review it early.
No. What I meant was, for example, if you want to get the newest Call of Duty multiplayer information, you have to go to the press event and try the multiplayer out there. That's the only way. Otherwise, you will have to wait until all the other magazines and websites have run the stories, and then you can talk about it yourself.
Yeah, and Daniel was mentioned, and this has happened. I don't know too many examples, but there are where they have review events where they kind of put a review, you know, like they bring them out to hotels and stuff, and they make them play the game for a day, and that's the only time you can review the game early. Other than that, you have to wait until it comes out in stores. Yeah. And, you know, the point of reviews is to kind of help guide people's expectations on to see if that's worth buying. So if you don't have it up early, you're kind of doing a disservice to your fans. But at the same time, you can't, you know, like these events kind of skew, even if you don't think it does kind of, oh, you know, I played it in this just setting, it was nice, they fed me, and stuff like that. So it is one of those things where it's really hard to not play ball, but at the same time, you have to maintain some type of journalistic integrity. The problem with that is that there isn't many examples, I should say, in the industry of somebody doing that, or any website who does. Most of the gaming websites run gaming ads in the background. They're sponsored by gaming companies. They have to go to these gaming events where a lot of the times the gaming companies, you know, PR departments pay for their travel, their hotel, their room. They put them up in really nice hotels to check out these games, and you have the PR guys and the, you know, sometimes you have developers on hand at these events to make sure you get the best possible experience if you get stuck there to help you out and stuff like that. And of course, online and stuff is also skewed because it's in a much smaller test zone.
Yep.
But I mean, going back to this problem real quick, I think the other thing and the biggest thing to me personally was the fact that she's a reporter, she's a journalist, and instead of trying to defend herself at all once, she hid her Twitter account.
And every time she was called out on something, she would erase evidence of it.
Yeah. And that's not an innocent party to me. That's somebody who knows that they're complacent in their guilt, and they're trying and they're hoping that they can hide the evidence, which makes no sense, because the only way you can find out that people are going to call you on it is once people start calling you on it. And,
yeah, like, and it's too late then. You can't stop it.
Yeah, like with the Square Enix stuff, there were screen caps way before she removed it. Once she removed it, people are just going to say, you look awful for it. And she admitted to being a consultant for Square and then saying she never reviewed a game for them. And then that came out that she reviewed games for them. So at some point, you know, like, if you don't have a leg to stand on, don't hide from it. This isn't going to go away. Like, honestly, I never even heard of her before this week.
And this is it. Reason why you know about her now is because her career has just gone down the toilet.
Yeah, and this has kind of it's not just her career. The guy left Eurogamer. He was a freelancer because he, you know, they edited his article because MCV threatened Daibu or Sander, and they had to edit it, and he just wouldn't stand for his words being edited. I assume for now, Eurogamer is probably in the trash. Nobody's going to take them seriously. And honestly, I've never taken MCV seriously. I believe they're the parent group for computers and video games.
Yeah,
and that's
there's been a lot of stuff about that website going around lately as well.
Oh, that's an awful website. I mean, I don't go to a lot of video game websites anymore. I just kind of hang out on Gaff and all the good stuff filters through, or Twitter. But I can usually tell their articles because they're much like Kotaku, in which they just kind of have to dress up the headlines a lot. So, like, they'll take one quote and they'll take it out of context and they'll wrap a headline around it just because they want people to click on it. And I understand that in this day and age, that's what people are more concerned with, hits and, you know, people going to their websites and actually doing their job well. But you can only do that trick so often before you begin to lose the respect of your audience, and your audience won't trust you anymore, and that's kind of what happened with them and me. I mean, like I said, I'm not huge on many video game websites, not just because I think they're corrupt or anything. I just find that they don't offer me anything I can't get elsewhere. Like, if it's not like many of them offer original content, I mean, you get good articles once out of the blue. Like, Kotaku had that article this week about Silicon Knight, and, you know, Dennis Dyack and his ego. That's a good journalistic article. There was the one about, not Ouya, what was it? What was the other stream? OnLive and their CEO and how he was batshit insane.
And as much as some people like to shit on Polygon and how they are quite mighty, I actually think they had some nice features.
Well, you see, Polygon, I think, is a different beast. It's not necessarily... I think they're on the other end of the spectrum where they're just eating their own shit. They think they're awesome, and they're making sure you know it, and I think that rubs people the wrong way.
Yeah, but...
There was nothing that turned me off more about Polygon than that stupid documentary that they did.
Yeah, like that stuff. Like, you know, we're such an important website.
Yeah,
of course.
I thought that stuff was stupid, but I actually think they have produced some nice feature articles on the website. But Matt Leon is writing for them, as far as I know. He was also pretty good at 1UP. And Russ Pitts, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
So, yeah, they have a lot of talent, and I'm sure they'll have a lot of great features. It's just that the website itself and the whole... Like, I mean, this website has been in development since the start of this year. They had the documentary. They've had this, we're coming. And then, you know, the website itself went up to dive this week for the first time. And that kind of got drowned out in the whole noise with this story. I do like the idea of their... What do they call it? Their bump reviews, where they can go back and edit a review as DLC and patches come in. It's an interesting idea. It's not going to gain much ground because I think people's opinions of a game doesn't really change once it's been out there. Like, it doesn't matter if like Resident Evil comes out with a patch that fixes everything and adds new content. It's still kind
of... What to mention is most games don't change that much.
Yeah, they don't. So, you know, yeah. it's who knows? I guess if there's a drastic change.
But anyway, what you were saying, by original content websites, I mean features. And features are kind of, in now that we are moving away from magazines and more and more the web, on some websites are just a thing of the past that no longer exists.
Yeah, and it's sad, because the most interesting stuff, and I mentioned this on Twitter this week, the most interesting stuff about the game industry tends to be the game industry. Not the games, not the people who make the game, but it tends to be, because this isn't the first time we've had a story like this. This isn't even the first time this year we've had a story like this.
No.
But it tends...
We had the story about Polygon.
Yeah, because they're sponsored by Microsoft.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not the first time. A lot of the things that come out are usually negative about either, not just the industry and the people who cover it, but fans, too. We spent most of the first part of this year talking about the Mass Effect 3 stuff and how that, you know, rubbed people the wrong way for one reason or another. So, at some point, I think... Oh, that reminds me. This drives me nuts. This drives me crazy. This drives me up the wall. Whenever people... use the defense that this is just video games. It doesn't need to be that serious.
Yeah, that's the stupidest thing ever. Have some fucking standards, people.
Yeah, and that's what drives me crazy. Like, oh, it's video games, don't worry about it. Like,
and this is the reason why we're making so much fuss about it, because we want people to take the things, the medium seriously, and not just go, oh, it's just video games. You know, people have been going, oh, it's just video games for fucking 30 years now. You know,
you can't have both, people.
Yeah, and that's what drives me nuts. Is personally speaking, I don't really care if the industry's taken seriously. It's taken where it needs to be taken, for as far as I'm concerned. People are, millions and millions of people are into video games. They enjoy them. They love them. They might not play the games people want them to play, but they play something. But you can't want that and still complain when stuff like this happens that people are taking it too seriously.
I mean, at this point, you have to take video games seriously.
Well, it's the biggest entertainment property. It's the biggest money maker in entertainment in the world now. So,
that's different. I don't think it's the biggest money maker because almost every company uses money on it. It just makes it out of revenue.
They are also now part of just popular culture, just as film or music or whatever, and those things are taken seriously. I mean. Yeah. I am of a generation which grew up with video games. I don't know anything different. And these younger people, I think it's even more extreme for them.
Yeah, and
they have video games everywhere around them nowadays.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and I think it speaks to that because it's this small sector of the gaming industry that doesn't think they're being taken seriously. Then I see something like the Ohio State halftime show where they're doing a homage to video games. I see something like Wreck-It Ralph, which is paying respect to video games. You know, they have a new Pac-Man cartoon coming out. People still know who Mario is. Shigeru Miyamoto is being honored again this week. At this point, I assume he just throws away these awards. And people are still like, video games aren't being taken seriously. Your bubble of the industry isn't being taken seriously, but people are playing Angry Birds, people are playing Words with Friends, people are playing Mario, Wii Sports, they're playing Just Dance, Dance Central, they're playing Cut the Rope, they're playing Farmville, they're playing this and that, they're playing video games, they're enjoying them, they're doing it on their browsers, their phones, their consoles, their handhelds. It's just that they're not playing the BioShocks, they're not playing the Mass Effects, they're not playing the Gears of War. And that's why people are like, you know, it needs to be taken seriously. They need to see Heavy Rain and they must weep because this is what movies should be or something like that.
Yeah, and if you don't think video games are being taken seriously, look up some articles from actually scientists who consider themselves in the field of game studies. This shit is being taken very seriously.
But again, it's not those.
I am studying this stuff, and I mean, I hold. I am doing a seminar on Wednesday about independent games. This stuff is taken very seriously, depending on the field. You just have to look for it.
Yeah, I just think it's, you know, I don't want to insult the sector because it's not everybody. I just think it's people who want certain things to be taken seriously. They want it to be held up to, like, the Citizen Kanes, the Matrix, the, you know, the great movies, the great arts, the great books, the great music. They want somebody to say, you know, this is our game. This is something that transcends the genre, and everybody wants to be a gamer now. And we've seen that time and time again. We saw it with Pac-Man. I mean, Pac-Man had a cartoon. Pac-Man had a hit song. Pac-Man had, you know, everything, T-shirts and stuff. We saw it with Mario, we saw it with Tetris, we saw it with Angry Birds, and still people are like, you know, it's not being seriously enough.
I think you're totally right there, and I also think at the same time you are totally wrong there, because yeah, it transcends a lot of things and media and people, but at the same time it's not like. It transcends everything. It's not like people always say we need the Citizen Kane of games. Not everyone likes Citizen Kane.
No, but I think that's something that people sometimes forget. There's no product in the history of mankind that is enjoyed by everybody. That's impossible.
Exactly.
Even if you came up with the perfect thing that gave everybody their wish, there'll be that one person. I don't like it. There will always be that one person, and if you want 100% acceptance, you're dealing with the wrong species. But yeah. the fact is that it does, you know, it transcends, it speaks to the larger generation. It doesn't just speak to the five, it doesn't just speak to the three of us, it doesn't just speak to the people on Twitter or Facebook or NeoGAF. It speaks to generations. I mean, a prime example, and I hate going back to this because it makes me seem bad, but a prime example is Mario. The reason Mario continues to persevere in gaming is because people like us grew up with it. And people older than us, and they bring their kids into that because it was something they remember from their childhood, and it's something that remains quality. So they can bring their kids, they can grow their kids up on that, and then their kids will come back and have their kids grow up on Mario. There's a reason that people bought Pac-Man CE or Pac-Man CE Championship Edition, because they know those are quality games, and it's something that takes them back to their youth. There's a reason that we still kind of yearn for arcades, even though they haven't really been a persistent part of American culture in 20 years. There's a reason Wreck-It Ralph has arcades as the backdrop of its movie. It's because it's the part of American culture that we understand, even if it's not a part of us on our day-to-day life anymore.
Exactly. So in that sense, video games are something to be taken seriously, and video games journalism is something to be taken seriously. It's not just, oh, it's just a silly thing. It doesn't matter what they do.
Yeah, and I think that's the big problem, is that if you don't hold them to that criteria, then you're never going to have the. And I don't want to pick on, because it's not just video games. This happens in movies. This happens But the thing is, with movies and music, there's still a standard from the old days. People like Ebert, you don't see him micro-blogging. You know, he doesn't do things just to get hits. He's still kind of using the old school method of reviewing. And there's still a group of people who do that. There are micro-bloggers. There's people who want attention. There's people, you know, like Armin White is a great example of a contrarian who just reviews stuff to get attention. So that exists, the internet. But there's nothing, I don't think you can really point to a website right now in gaming that you can say, like, okay, you know what, this is a mainstream website, it does things by the books, we accept it, it's good, it's, you know, it's where I go for writing. Like, there's websites that try it, right? Rock, Paper, Shotgun is one that people tend to point out. Gamersupers is another one.
Yeah, and that's one thing about what you said about movies as well. Here in Germany, I can still buy, if I seek it out, a magazine which still reviews films. Well, you don't review even the wrong word. Critiques films in the way, I don't know, someone like Krakauer did it like 50 years ago or something like that. Like in a very intelligent way with looking at philosophical themes and stuff like that, and I think that also plays for something like that in games.
Yeah, I think the other problem with games, and this is something that I try not to do, and I mean sometimes you're just kind of forced to because of the way the industry works and the way people's attention span is that you spend Skyrim, Skyward Swords, Fallout, you spend 50, 60, 70 hours on these games, and then you have to throw out a review in 2 hours. It doesn't work. It doesn't, you know, it's really hard to do, to just say, if you just finished a game, here's a review of it.
Let's go back to features. Do the review, and maybe later do a feature about specific things you have seen, experienced, whatever.
See, I would do that the other way around.
You think?
Because reviews, I mean, honestly speaking, the majority of content anybody reads from a website is reviews. So I would want a review to be something that you thought about, something that you've broken down, something that you've dissected and, you know, mulled over in your head 100 times to make sure that you absolutely understand what you want to say. It's one of the reasons I enjoy doing this show. It's like we do reviews on the site, not all the time, but we do. But a lot of times it tends to be that we talk about the games we're playing on the show ahead of time. And this way you kind of get that back. And I do this with almost all my reviews, even if it's not on the show. I'll speak to somebody to better understand how I want to express my view, but also to try to articulate what I enjoy and what I didn't enjoy and how it didn't work for me. And I think that's not something you always have options to. I mean, for example, Martin had to do this with Mark Akai, where you played through that game in Echo Weekend.
Yeah. It's not ideal. And I have to say, it's not the most fun way to play a game.
No, it isn't. It isn't. No. Because you're not playing for enjoyment. You're playing just for completion. I mean, contrast that with the fact that I saw Wreck-It Ralph a week and a half ago, and I'm still mulling over my review because I didn't just want to, you know, I think it's a benchmark movie for video games, and I'm going to recommend you see it. But I wanted to make sure I understood what I wanted to say and why I think it's a good movie and why I think it's a good video game movie. And that was something that I had to think about. And you kicked the ass night where I finally figured out why I wanted to speak about it as a video game movie and not just do a traditional review. Like, Wreck-It Ralph has great animation, voice acting's good, and the CG's amazing. Because, yeah, you can get that, but it's not telling you anything you wouldn't know already.
Yeah. That's what I do most of the time myself when I have to review them. It's not like, oh, I see it and then I write it the same day. It's mostly I try to at least sleep over it like a day or two before I even start writing.
Yeah.
Because I have to sort out my thoughts and feelings about what I've seen.
And I think that there is a discussion to be had here and everywhere that maybe we should think of doing we should have a discussion about what we need in a video game review. Like, a lot of the times, video game reviews have kind of grown up in the design of movie reviews. We've grown up on the 5-point scale, the 10-point scales, the star scales, and stuff like that. And that works for movies because movies are something you digest in 2 hours. And a lot of the cases, you can mull about them for a week or so because a lot of these press screenings are way in advance. Where a video game is something that, you know, you have to factor in price, you have to factor in time, you have to factor in enjoyment, you have to factor in system, you have to factor in online. And a lot of these things aren't always uniform. It's not easy to say Call of Duty. And this especially goes true for multi-platform games. You can't say Call of Duty on the PS3 is the same experience as Call of Duty on the 360. Different controllers, different audiences. I mean, I've been playing Payday the Heist on the PS3 this week, and it's one of the major differences between the PS3 and the 360 is the just talking, because the 360 by default comes with a microphone, so it tends to be strange when nobody's talking in a game. Where I find it strange when I find somebody who's actually talking in a PlayStation.
Yeah, Payday the Heist is a game that is so much harder when nobody speaks to each other.
Yeah. So, and that's a huge part of it. And I think, you know, like, we've tried different stuff, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it falls by the wayside, because, I mean, one of the things we tried to implement so that we wouldn't be rushing reviews is that we introduced the power hour, which gives you an idea of, like, okay, I can talk about the game for the first hour. This way I can kind of play through it at my leisure, but you can still kind of get an idea of if I'm enjoying it or not. Because I think you can get an idea of a game, especially this day and age where most of them are no more than 10 hours within its first hour.
Except, but, you know, it's called Final Fantasy XIII.
Yeah, and another thing, I don't even really read reviews anymore. The things I find most useful, for example, are Giant Bomb's quick looks, because I think they give me more information in 30 minutes of watching them play. Just hearing them react to what they're playing is a lot more beneficial to me than a 1,000 or 2,000 word preview.
And it's not without reason that lots of other websites have started copying.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, going back to something that worked, and I think we should look into it. I know it's always a time issue, but EGM used to do a review by panel. You'd have 3 reviews on a game, and everybody would assign an individual score. This way you would kind of get a wide range of opinions on a title. I mean, a lot of the times it would all kind of fall within the same range. But, you know, like, one person would enjoy something, the other person probably wouldn't enjoy it as much, but they marked it up for something they enjoyed a lot more than the other person. And I think that's, again, something that needs to be discussed, because there's no one person who can speak for everybody, and there's no one thing that's going to represent an entire game. So I think, you know, that's always a great idea as well. And, it's a time commitment. You can't have, like, 4-year reviewers playing Skyrim, because that's just a time commitment that could be used for other games coming out in the fall.
Yeah.
But, yeah. apparently we spent a lot of time on that one news article, so we're just going to speed through the other ones really quick. G4 is ending X-Fay and Attack of the Show this December.
I don't know what that is. And I don't care.
It sounds like that G4 was going that way since Cecilia left.
Yeah, I mean, it was announced anyhow that they were rebranding. I don't really care about these shows being canceled. I mean, Cecilia F and Kevin F, the Attack of the Show, or whatever. I didn't even watch G4 to begin with. The only thing they were good for was the E3 coverage. My problem with this isn't so much the cancellation of the shows. It's the fact that they figured that they're going to cater to this very niche market of males between 18 and 34. Because God knows we don't have enough content that caters to us.
Yeah.
And we have channels dedicated to that already. We have Spike TV. We have MTV. We have MTV2.
And Spike has pretty good video game coverage, because they've got GTTV.
Which you can watch on the website.
Yeah.
And the problem is, a lot of these shows are just really, like, if you're a stupid guy, like a jock, a frat boy, or something like that, and they don't really cater. And you know, like, if you wanted to do something different and do it the same, cater to an 18 to 34-year-old nerd male. Have, like, you know, shows we'd be interested in watching. I don't want to see Manches or 100,000 Ways to Die or... Yeah, there's this stupid show on MTV, I forget the name of it, where it's just, like, dating tips from, like, jerk guys, like, how to be a player and all this other stuff. I don't care about that stuff. I want one person. I don't want 100 of them. Who wants that headache?
But then you would expect DXX to do something different and interesting.
Yeah, and that's my problem. It's like, at least before, they had something different. Granted, the channel mostly showed Cops and Cheetahs reruns, but it was different because it had these shows. Now it's just going to be like Spike TV Jr., which is a terrible channel to begin with. So yeah, there's that. GameStop Kids, which is honestly something I already heard about when I was looking for news for this week. And I actually think it's a great idea. I don't know how GameStop is in your countries, but here you can go to certain malls in certain areas of town, and there'll be like three GameStops within a 5-minute walk of each other.
That's how Game was in this country until they closed pretty much every one of their stores.
There are not many GameStops here, and I mostly try to avoid those because they have terrible prices.
Yeah, but this
is every other shop is a better alternative.
Yeah, but this would be like focused on like the age of 10 and under games, and it would be for kids who want to buy their own game. But I think more importantly, why it would work is because it's for parents who sometimes parents don't necessarily understand the rating systems, or they don't, you know, like their kids say, "Buy me Call of Duty," and they just kind of go with it. This is kind of like, it only has those E10 and under games that are appropriate for children. And I'm not necessarily saying that Call of Duty is inappropriate for children. I don't think a lot of M-rated games have content that a kid couldn't handle, because it doesn't have content that most people couldn't handle, because it's just blood. But it's nice for parents and to kind of keep them informed and stuff like that. And honestly, I don't need three GameStops in my local mall, so might as well make something different. Nintendo Direct and Investors meeting this week. One, I am super surprised that the Nintendo Direct this week was focused on the 3DS. I swear,
you're not the only one. I think, have you seen my tweet? I think I even mentioned, like, shouldn't Nintendo have, like, a thing about the Wii U where they talk about stuff that we still don't know?
I mean, you would think that the system was a ways off. We are 3 weeks from the system releasing as of this recording. 3 weeks. It doesn't give them a lot of time to talk about this.
We're still trying to puzzle out online. We just discovered there is such a thing as a Nintendo Network ID.
Yeah, the fact that people are kind of piecemealing together there.
I know, it is, though.
And it's not just that. I mean, it's like it's not only that, but it's been really like, other than Ubisoft this week with the Zombie U and the Rayman Legend stuff, like, it hasn't really been much in the way of Nintendo game stuff for the Wii U since September at that press conference. We haven't had a new trailer for Mario or Nintendo Land, or we just found out that Razor's Edge is a launch title. They had a new trailer for that.
Close to the Wii U's release date as well.
Yeah, like, 3 weeks from us. I think it's like 5 weeks for you, but it's 3 weeks from today for us. They have 3 weeks to kind of get the ball rolling. And part of it, and this kind of came out in the investors, that they only have 5.5 million Wii U's for the first 5 months or so. So maybe they just assume that we're going to sell out our launch allotment and probably whatever we have, so we don't need to spend a lot of money advertising. But
it probably will, but it would still be pretty nice to, well, give your potential customers some information. I mean,
yeah.
I have gotten so insecure about my Wii U pre-order, I actually cancelled it.
And I've been saying this since like September, is that I am still on the fence about it, because I still don't have enough information on what to expect with online, with the Miiverse and stuff like that. And I think it's, you know, like, none of it's going to be a deal breaker for me, but I do think that it will help swing if I know what I'm getting when I buy the system, and not necessarily a surprise. Like, I don't expect a Wii level online, because I honestly don't think they can be that stupid twice.
Yeah.
But they need to speak about it, especially being that it's the one area. Well, it's not the one area, but it's the biggest area, I would have to say, that people have problems with them this generation, was their online network.
Yep. And I've mentioned dozens of times before, I don't know if on this podcast though, does everybody remember how the Xbox 360 was revealed at E3 in 2005?
Well, it was revealed at the MTV show, right?
I don't know, not even the MTV show, meaning the press conference. When they broke down everything about how Xbox Live is going to work. when they showed you, hey, you as the player, you will have your gamer tag thing. To this, there will be attached this gamer score. And here, this is how this will interconnect with the friends list. And this is how we envision maybe further down this is going to go. They broke it down to everything. Even the gamer picture and stuff. We don't know anything about how Nintendo is going to do it.
Yeah, and that's why when they said there was a Nintendo, I'm like, finally, and then it's like 3DS, I'm like, okay, not where I thought you would go, and especially being that you didn't really announce anything new for most of us. Like, I'm excited for Paper Mario as the next guy, but I knew about Paper Mario, I've seen enough Paper Mario, Luigi's Mansion is not until next year, Animal Crossing is next year, you don't really need to tell me about that stuff in October. I mean, it was nice of you to have a press, little thing. You see, they should have done it in reverse. You should have had more focus on the Wii U and had the 3DS stuff at the end, but whatever. Aside from that, Nintendo continues to lose money and doesn't really think it's going to change in the future, as they're selling the Wii U for us as well, which makes it the first time they're selling a launch system.
I have to say, I'm actually surprised that they're seeing it as a loss. I guess mostly because of the controller. It's what I would suspect.
I'd imagine so, too. And it also depends on how much we're also talking here.
That's true.
Because I don't think we're talking Sony type.
Yeah, it's not going to be like that.
And I assume they expect to make it up on the hardware side. So, yeah, it is that. And finally, in news, because they are such a shining example of the future of mobile gaming, we had more Zynga news this week, as they... I don't even know if they are imploded at this point. It just seems like the house of cards has just thrown over for them, and everything's just kind of fallen to the wayside. They closed down... I believe they only closed down one branch, but they let go most of the staff in two other branches. They closed down the Austin branch, and then they let go staff in the hundreds, I think, for the Boston and Chicago branch.
Yeah.
And people losing their jobs always suck, and, it is what it is. And I'm not one of those people who hates Zynga. I don't hate any company. I think it's kind of odd. But I will say they did try that THQ maneuver, which, again, is kind of the Streisand effect, where they fired the people during Apple's keynote so that they wouldn't be the main story.
Yeah, and because I think layoffs, and this is the thing, is it's not just a few layoffs, it's a lot of them. And it was never going to go unnoticed. It doesn't matter how hard you try, especially when it's, Zynga, which is supposedly the shining example of social gaming, and it's the company that everybody loves to hate. Even EA, and I don't know, they would have had less press had they just not bothered trying.
It's the Streisand effect. It's the same thing that THQ tried when they closed down those branches during E3, is that once the story picks up, people are going to notice it. And I think it's going to, especially with Zynga, since they're such a hated company, what you're going to see is like people are going to notice it. But once it comes out that you did this during such a time to hide it, that's when people pounce on you.
Yeah.
And it's always going to come out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not like the internet's a new thing. It's like social media just popped up overnight. This has been around for decades now. Get used to it. You can't hide from things. You can't hide things on the internet.
They're always going to try.
Yes, you're always going to try. And you could be smarter than 95% of the people in the room. It's that 5% that's going to screw you over and tell the other 95%. And that's all you need.
And actually, about the Zynga thing, I guess it wasn't really surprising that this was going to happen. I mean, with their stock situation.
And they've had important people, turf up confidential documents and quit and... figures in turmoil, to say the least.
Yeah.
And so,
what I mean,
especially in an industry where layoffs are not an uncommon thing at all anymore,
Yeah, and usually the most those stories get is, oh, that sucks, I feel bad for him, I hope they end on their feet. And then it kind of moves on because it's something that, honestly, at this point, we get them like every week. it's not something new, it's not something different. But hiding it, trying to bury it, trying to make yourself look better, that draws attention to it. It always has. It's done it 3 times this year already. It did it with the Kingdoms of Amalur team. They didn't try to hide that, but you know that became a bigger story once the details started coming out. Happened with THQ, and it happened on Ive. And again, these people are like, okay, you know, we're smarter than that company. We'll just try it anyhow.
Yeah.
So, is there anything else you folks want to add before we begin to wrap for this week?
Really. Lauren Wainwright, you're stupid. I don't mean it in any kind of offensive way, but...
Oh, yeah, that was the other thing that we didn't mention. It's like a lot of people are defending her because they think it's sexist.
No, she's an idiot. She did a stupid thing, followed by a stupid thing, followed by a stupid thing. It's not sexist at all.
And it's not just her, but
she was this guy. This Dave Cook was called out as well, and he held his hands up and he was like, yeah, I'll get rid of the PS3, you know.
Yeah.
The thing I don't... Maybe it's because they're small press. I would think that most presses at this point have a PS3 or a 360 and a Wii. I mean, if it's your job to cover the video game industry,
you need the tools to do it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't necessarily think it was a bad thing that they got a PS3. I mean, it happens. Like, if they went to the show and somebody randomly gave it to them, you know, it's one. Like, Microsoft gave it at E3 to 360s. What can you do? They're giving it to you. What most people who did were give it away. That's fine.
Yeah, exactly.
But what happened here is you had to actively seek it, and two, you did it by becoming a viral marketer, which crosses the line because it's not even that blurry line. You are a viral marketer for a company you're supposed to be covering, so you're dependent on their success. But anyhow, I think we've talked enough about this. It's going to be a very interesting dynamic when this actually comes out, because we have half of it Halloween, half of it the corruption in the video game industry. Two very different topics. But you can find us on Twitter, you can find us on Facebook, you can find us on the website. We have stuff related to video games. We don't really cover video game news. We do reviews and features because, honestly, that's a really interesting thing to cover. And all those fun links will be on the website with the article, the podcast, I should say. So for Daniel, Martin, and myself, this has been Dual Worlds episode 87.